This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Do you say and do things when drinking that you regret the next day? Is alcohol a problem for you or someone you really care about? Over the next hour, we'll find out how people just like you and me found sobriety in AA through sharing their experience, strength and hope. Welcome to AA Live, brought to you by Alcoholics Anonymous.
Kia ora, e te whanau. Welcome to AA Live Radio Show. This is a show that explores the ideas behind a way of recovery through the Alcoholics Anonymous program. Thank you for joining us from around the motu and around the world this evening and joining Mike in the studio. Hi, Mike.
Hello, hello. How are we going?
Good, good, good. And myself in the studio, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to our guest, Morgan. Hey, Morgan.
Kia ora.
Cool. Thanks. Hey, thanks for taking the time for joining us both tonight. And how's your day been? What's been happening?
Oh, it's been a pretty good day for me today. I love Fridays. It's my favourite day of the week. Just work, and because of coming here, I had an early knock-off. So.
Oh, nice work.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Great.
Yeah.
And Mike, what have you been up to?
I went to a lunchtime AA meeting today.
Very good.
Yeah, it was good. I went to another recovery meeting earlier in the morning. Recovery day.
Back to back, and here we are.
Back to back, yeah. I hit the first recovery meeting I ever went to was at the Salvation Army, and I still keep going back to that group. Oh, no. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Very supported.
Yeah. Been pretty lucky with programs like this one, AA, and also the Sally's and stuff. It's pretty amazing
what's out there, yeah.
Yeah. No thanks to the government. Not that we're getting political on the show.
No, we're not. So let's get started. Alcoholics Anonymous is a service based on alcoholics helping other alcoholics. We do the work through a 12-step program where recovering alcoholics support each other who want to stop drinking and where we learn how to live life. We do the mahi together and work through the 12 steps. People come into the rooms with a range of thoughts and reasons about their life problems with alcohol and really what our AA is about. Some of these reasons run along the lines like this. I can stay sober for a while between binges, but how can I tell whether I need AA? Or another one is there a definition of alcoholism and do I fit this description? Or my friends say to me that I'm not an alcoholic, but my drinking seems to be getting worse. Should I join AA? And then final one that's pretty on point is, won't everyone know that I'm an alcoholic if I come into the AA rooms? For me, working through the AA program and being invested in recovery is about bringing through a new version of life and living. What I recognise now from being in the rooms or by way of online meetings, which can happen all through the country, mostly in the evenings, is that everyone's journey of recovery is in their own time and with by way of their own understanding. But we do have a common bond, and that we all have a problem initially, you know, with drinking, whether that's by how much we drink in terms of volume and frequency, or by maybe digging deeper of how relationships or the relationships that we have or I have are controlled or impacted by these behaviours. That's quite intense, eh? But I thought it was a nice way to sort of set the scene for the show tonight. And Mike, would you like to take it from here?
Yeah, sure thing. So, yeah, the AA preamble, I'll give that a read. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. And our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So that's the preamble, and we sort of kick most meetings off with something like that. So just to let you know that what you hear tonight on the show are the opinions of of us in this show and not the opinions of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole or an organisation.
Great disclaimer.
Yeah. Including my comments on the government. we have guests who are invited to share their story and experience. However, as a whole, it's just us as recovering alcoholics talking about different aspects of our recovery.
Nice work. And, this next part, we always love going into the daily reflection, which is a common thing in how we set up meetings often too. In each meeting, they'll always,
we'll
have a daily reflection. Mm. Yeah, so. Yeah,
there's a little book of collections, and there's a reading for every day. So shall we have a look at the daily reading today?
Fantastic. Thanks, Mike. So we're looking at June the 3rd, which reads from the book from Alcoholics Anonymous, page 76, and it's titled On a Wing and a Prayer. And it goes on to say, when we took step 6, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Step 4 and 5 were difficult but worthwhile. Now I was stuck on step 6 and, in despair, I picked up the big book and read this passage. I was outside praying for willingness when I raised my eyes and saw a huge bird rising in the sky. I watched it suddenly give itself up to the powerful air currents of the mountains. Swept along, swooping and soaring, the bird did things seemingly impossible for mortal birds to do. It was an inspiring example of a fellow creature letting go to a power greater than itself. I realised that if the bird took back its will and tried to fly with less trust on its power alone, it would spoil its apparent free flight. That insight granted me the willingness to pray the seventh step prayer. It's not easy to know God's will in each circumstance. I must search out and be ready for the currents, and that's where prayer and meditation help. Because I am, of myself, nothing, I ask God to grant me the knowledge of His will and the power and courage to carry it out today.
Cool. That's a cool reading, eh?
Yeah.
I quite like how it sort of talks about, a power greater than itself, and it talks, I guess it's talking about wind currents and things, but that's nice. It's kind of a nice reflection on that, you know, everyone's higher power is kind of their own journey and their own interpretation of. I thought it was a nice metaphor.
Yeah, I think so too.
Right.
I like the idea of just letting go. I think it's different for people. People come into the rooms and they, my partner, Yvonne, for example.
Yeah.
She came into AA. She loved her drinking. She loved to drink. She had a boyfriend at the time who didn't like her drinking. She came into AA for him. And she loved her lifestyle. She ran bars. She managed pubs. And she came into AA and she hasn't had a drink since her first meeting.
It's remarkable.
It's a miracle, man. Like, I just can't understand how she got it so, like, but she did. She did. When Yvonne does something, she does it 100%. And so when she's present somewhere, she's fully there. And so she heard, obviously, what was intended for her to hear. She identified with so many things that were being said by the people in the rooms in that first meeting, and she made the decision to never pick up a drink again. And I wasn't like that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but there you go.
It took a couple of goes or, you know.
Yeah, well, like, the willingness thing.
The willingness.
I was definitely, I always thought I was willing, because I was willing to come to meetings, right? But I didn't really understand what the context of how that willingness was supposed to, like, I'm willing to, what length are you prepared to go to? And I thought I was prepared to go to any length, but I wasn't actually. When I look back at my journey, I wasn't prepared to be completely honest.
Yeah, it's the honesty thing. So you still sort of had some guard up, or
defects of character.
Defects of character. yeah.
Yeah. well, that's what I call them, defects of character. They definitely held me back, and yeah, it was difficult.
And then steps 4 and 5, which get kind of mentioned in the reading, that's where you sort of look at those defects of character, eh?
Well,
moral inventories and stuff.
There was plenty of that. I think you know, when I came into AA, there were some really good old timers there, and the message for me was keep coming back and read the literature. So read the big book. That was a very, very, it was a big emphasis on newcomers. Literature used to get sold, like, you used to have to do orders for literature.
On a regular basis.
On a very regular basis, because everybody bought the literature and read the literature. And I think now with phones and all that sort of thing, I don't think people feel a need to read a book.
Or maybe there's different ways of accessing information, or, yeah, it depends on who, if you're fortunate enough to get a good sponsor or a sponsor that wants to step you through, then maybe, you know, you read the literature with that and that type of, you know, with that interaction, you know what I mean, going through the book.
I've got an app that's called Everything AA that has lots of the readings and things on, so I can read it on my phone, which is convenient and cool, especially when I'm travelling, but like, it's nothing like a book, I reckon. Like,
can you listen to them?
Yeah, because you can listen
to them too.
Yeah. And YouTube, you can listen to most of the big book chapters and stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing, though.
No, it's different.
Mm.
Yeah.
You need the paper, the highlighter pen, and the you know, the bent over pages.
But it makes it sort of accessible. But I mean, I love a book, opening a book and stuff.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always found, like going back to that reading, that idea of that willingness. I identify with what you're saying, Morgan, was I was willing to do, you know, step one, absolutely step one. My life was unmanageable and I was powerless over alcohol and I could go through those next steps. But when I get to like having some, like giving over or like, here, take away everything, not from me, I just, it would took, and it still can take me a while to get that into my little brain because I am resistant at times, I still want to be able to, I think I can still do it myself.
Yeah.
Though I know that it's not ideal.
No. I think, to be completely willing to change your whole way of doing things, your whole way of being, then the old way of being has to be demonstrated, has to be smashed, and you have to be smashed with it.
Yeah.
All right, that's how it was for me. I had to be thoroughly, thoroughly smashed in my whole way of life before I came to a place where I really, really was sick of it, and I just didn't want to be like that anymore, and that's when I became willing. But it took a long time. I spent 13 years coming in and out of AA, drinking, relapsing, and all that sort of carry on, and coming back with my tail between my legs. And every time I came back, I was always welcome back. But it just seemed like after a while that I was one of those people that was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. That's what I thought I was.
And that's a classic quote out of the big book, isn't it, for everyone listening? Yeah.
And that's what I thought I was. But when I finally, you know what, like there's an old saying in AA about hitting rock bottom and how when we hit rock bottom as an alky, we look for a shovel. Do you know what I mean? Mm.
Yeah, you want to go further down.
Well, we do. Yeah. We just look for a shovel and we can go. And so no matter how low I've gone, even my last bottom where I was thrashed to the point where I became willing, I give up, kind of place. I still know that there's another level there for me to go, if I pick up the drink. Yeah, that's how I know that intimately. So, you know, that's why I go to any length now to to be happy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Look joyous at you now, smiling across the room from me.
Joyous and free, yeah.
Joyous
yeah.
and free.
Mm. It's not like that all the time, of course. That's just one of the beautiful sayings we have in AA. It's a goal, yeah.
Hey, so we're going to play one of your favourite tracks now. Which one were you thinking, Morgan?
George Harrison's My Sweet Lord. Love that song.
Oh, fantastic. Here we go.
It's quite good on the concept of high power as well, eh?
Mm.
I really wanna know you.
We're back in the rooms. So George Harrison, eh, Morgan?
Yeah, I like George. I like the song. Love the song, actually.
Yeah. Pretty uplifting.
Yeah, it is. I just think it's one of those songs that I can sing along to when there's no one around. I just love the song.
It's a beautiful
everything
song,
about it. Yeah, the harmonising and the words, you know, just lovely.
I think it's a Phil Spector. I think Phil Spector produced that song.
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome producer, Strange Fellow.
Mm. Strange Fellow? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hey, let's get back on track. So I thought tonight we might spend some time with you, Morgan, talking through, and Mike, of course, talking through a couple of those initial statements that I had in the introduction. And in terms of your experience, Morgan, and how you understood your relationship to alcohol back in the day, and then maybe how your life has changed and transformed by your work and commitment in the AA program, because that's how I know you.
Mm-hmm.
And we've become, you know, I've got to know...
Very good friends.
Very good friends. Yeah. And I'm a youngin' compared to you. Like, I really look up to you, and I really enjoy your sharing in the rooms. And what I love too is you change it up, you can change it down, you can read the room, you know, and it's just got all these little nuggets of wisdom, and it's they incredibly at times, I mean, you're such a comedian at times, but then underneath that line, it's just like there's such much seriousness to the what your message and sort of how you value what you have today.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the end of the day, it's life and death, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's a disease that kills. I couldn't even count the number of people, alcoholics, that have come in and out of these rooms, and a lot of them have passed away, you know. My relationship with alcohol, before I realised I was a problem drinker, I loved it. When I started drinking really early, I was maybe 12, and I used to get drunk with all the other street kids, really, in Christchurch. And I just loved, because I've always felt like different. I'll look at other people and I just think, how do they know just how to do that? You know, how do they know how to function like that? How can I used to look at people just like talking in the street, and I just think, how do they know what to say to each other? I've always like felt really, really incapable of being able to just communicate with people and like on a person to person level, because I've always felt like people are looking at me like I'm less than. I've always felt like worse than anyone else on the planet. I don't know where that comes from, that I've just never belonged. And so when I drank alcohol, I just felt like Superman, to be honest. I was bulletproof, and that was probably the worst feeling I could have got from anything, really, because it made me obnoxious, turned me into a bully. I did a lot of crime.
Mm-hmm.
I did criminal behaviour. I got locked up a lot. I got made a state, ward of the state. You know, I come from a family. My mum and dad were both alcoholic drinkers, and my dad was a pretty scary dude. He didn't talk much. I used to look at my dad, and I used to like just feel sorry for him. I used to think, God, you need someone to talk to. I felt sorry for him. I just thought, fuck, I wish he had someone to talk to, Dad, you know. And he didn't open up, and he was so surly and intimidating. And but he could be beautiful too. Mm-hmm. He could be beautiful as well. And but when he drank, both mum and him, you know, when they drank, they got drunk and they just did stupid things. Dad was violent. Mum cried. She'd be happy and the start of her drinking, then she'd be bawling her eyes out by the end of the night. And
that must have been so confusing.
It was just normal. And mum, and for me, sure. It was normal. Like, I grew up, that's what we saw. Oh, Mum. Okay. Anyway, and Dad, you just knew you had to just stay out of his way, and you just don't upset him. And even when he's not drinking, more so when he's not drinking, he would humiliate us as well. as well as the violence, he would humiliate us in public. And, you know, my brother, we had a cat called Mr. Thompson, and my brother was just a wee chubby wee boy, and he was supposed to take Mr. Thompson round the pet show. He was showing him off at a, I can't remember what it was, Industries Fair or something. And we were all there as a family, and my little brother didn't want to do it, and he started crying. And so he's going around with Mr. Thompson, with all the other kids and all the other pets, crying. He's crying. And so, I don't know, this enraged my old man. And at the end of the show, all the kids got an ice cream. And the guy went up and gave my little brother the ice cream, and my father just went straight up to him and backhanded the ice cream out of his hand, and it just went flying. And it was just so humiliating. Mm-hmm. He embarrassed us in front of so many people. And I, you know, and that's what my dad would do. And that's how I would feel. I would feel like, oh my God, you know. And yeah, so stuff like that wasn't nice. But anyway, my relationship with alcohol became dependent. And I was an everyday drinker at the end. I couldn't stop drinking. And there were so many times where I tried to stop drinking. You know, I tried to control my drinking as well. I'd only drink, you know, at certain times, but those times just got out of control. And then my behaviour just got worse as well. I was a violent drunk. I was, you know, I'd commit burglaries. You know, I've served time for burglaries, I've served time for violence, I've still got some old traits from those times, like I always have my wallet under my pillow at home to this day. I take it out of my pocket and put it under my pillow every night, because I've been that guy that's broken into your house and stolen your wallet off your bedside cabinet.
If you don't mind me asking, Morgan, was that sort of like your robberies and stuff? Was that to support your drinking? And
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, 100%. Because I needed money to do my stuff and to get my. And it wasn't just the drinking; I was using all sorts of substances. Mm. I've had, you know, I lived in Wellington from 79 to 82, and I lived with five prostitutes, for example. Mm. And those girls, they loved their prescription medicines, and they introduced me to like all sorts of stuff up there. Got really, really messy, and also their main clientele were Japanese fishermen, and the Japanese fishermen loved their whiskey. So I drank a lot of whiskey during that time as well. I've always been a beer drinker, really, to be honest. I love my beer, and so there hasn't been much in terms of substances, drugs, and alcohol that I haven't tried, and I got. Really quite sick physically, but the drinking has been the constant right throughout. And I read in the big book a passage that said you will if I work the program, you will recoil from alcohol as if from a hot flame. And I thought, well, that's never going to happen for me. I'm never going to recoil from alcohol. I love the stuff.
Still had a contagious relationship with it.
Very much so. When I read that, I just thought, and this was after a few years too, right? And I'm thinking, I'm never going to recoil from drink. You know, I just could not see that happening for me. I just couldn't see it happening for me. And it's happened.
Well, where was your first meeting? You know, like if you, I know that you said that you were in the rooms or... sober for 13 years and...
Yeah, well, trying to get sober. Well, I did my first meeting in Paparoa Prison, 1983. So that's 42 years ago.
It's the year I was born.
Oh, okay, so... Yeah, well, happy birthday, mate.
You go, young pup.
Yeah. That makes me feel old, mate. But anyway, I was in jail. I was doing a lag and the screw came around the wing and, anyone want to go to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? Just to get out of the cell. So I got out of the cell and did a few meetings. And it was all about biscuits and cigarettes, because this was the cellies that were bringing the meeting in, carrying the message. and they bought cigarettes and biscuits. So that was a good deal, I thought. Get out of the cell and get smokes and biscuits. So, but it wasn't until 1991 when I came into AA in Dunedin that my probation officer, who I had rung because I was, she wasn't my probation officer. We were between sentences, but she'd become like a sort of a friend, and she was the only person that I could talk to that would talk to me. No one else wanted to talk. That's the other thing about my relationship with alcohol. It completely destroyed my relationships with other people. Mm. I already struggled with getting on with people. I've never been a people person. I've always felt less than everybody else and spent my whole drinking career trying to be on top of everybody else that people just, they don't want to be around that sort of energy, or they never wanted to be around me. And I don't blame them. You know, I wouldn't want to be around me either when I'm drinking. And
so when you came back into the Dunedin rooms, and that's when you started to really, well, not started to, because you had an idea of what sobriety looked like.
Oh,
but
well, when
of
my,
course you did, yeah.
Well, I don't know if I had an idea of what it was like. My probation officer says, you need to, have you thought about going to AA, Morgan? So she was basically, she was the first person to say, you've got a problem drinking, mate. Your drinking is out of control. So I went along and I went there, and there was a whole lot of old people there, Jack G and Des and Alex and all these other people. And I just thought, man, these people are not going to relate to me. I don't even relate to these people. I mean, they're so different from me. So there I was, just separating myself from the people that, you know, in the end are going to save my life, really. And I insulted the room. Somebody asked me to share, and I insulted the room and said some stuff. And that was how I usually dealt with being the centre of attention. I would act out, you know. And then this old guy came up to me after the meeting and says, I just keep coming back, mate. You just keep coming back. And no one had ever invited me back anywhere, so I thought, okay, I'll keep coming back. So from that was 1991 till 2004, I was in and out of AA, relapsing, right, drinking all the time. And I'd get a year up, and then for some reason, but all the way through that 13 years, that's the period where I'm saying, and believing myself when I'm saying, I'm never going to recoil from alcohol. You know, that's not going to happen for me. And then my last drink in 2004, I drank two bottles of whiskey, two 40-ounce, I sculled them down, and I got violent enough to go to prison, go to jail, and the judge said to me, you've got a lot of support, Morgan, you've done a lot of things, and I had done a lot of things. I was working, I had clearance, security clearance, to go into the police cells and assess prospective clients for a program that I was working for. Mm. I was working at Moana House for a wee while.
Right.
Yeah, and I also had, I was doing things that just, you couldn't even imagine. I wasn't being honest up until that stage. And then, anyway, the judge says, well, you've obviously done some very good work and you've got a lot of support, Morgan, but you, or Mr. Nathan, you chose to drink, and when you drank, you returned to type. And when he said return to type, I was just like, I was already ashamed. I was so full of shame. And when he said return to type, I was like, yeah, God, you're so right. And that made me feel even more ashamed.
Hmm.
And, but I was also, at the time, I was also, I had started to pray. I'd started to pray. There was an old-timer, Jack. He came into the police house to visit me and asked me, how are you going, mate? And I says, I'm not going good, Jack. And I was expecting Jack to, you know, give me the sympathy card, and he didn't. And because that's what I wanted. I wanted all the sympathy. And Jack says, well, Morgan, you need to realise that your circumstances as they are right now are exactly as they're meant to be. You need to give thanks to God and praise Him for your plan, for His plan for you. And I sat there and I just thought, my God. And I went back to my cell and I thought, holy hell. And I had no choice. I said to myself, you got no choice. I got no choice.
We definitely don't have any choices. You know, here you are in prison,
yeah.
You know, and then you've been, you know, there's people, and especially it sounds like Jack.
Mm.
And, you know, you really respected him.
That was his message. Jack, I love Jack. Everyone loved Jack. And Jack was one of us, but he was, well, at that stage he would have been 48. He died 50, I think he was 55. Years sober. He was the longest term sobriety in New Zealand. And but that was his message, give thanks and praise for everything. Everything is as it should be. So I don't know why I expected anything different. And but I just sat in my cell and I just said, thank you, Lord. Thank you for your plan for me and for your wisdom. And I asked for eyes to see that plan and the power to carry it out, if it be your will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the contribution, I mean, there's now, a few months ago, you had your 20 years milestone or celebration?
Yeah.
It was pretty powerful. It was powerful for me.
Yeah. Yeah, 20 years sober. And my last drink was August 30th, 2004. So I'll be 21 years in August 30 this year. And, you know, I couldn't think of anything worse than having a drink. I recoil from the thought of drinking. And, you know, my sobriety, my family, and my work. And my prayer. Those are the things that keep me going and giving me the life that I've got today. So I've got my own wee business. I work for myself.
You're a very industrious person, eh? That way. And
and
that whole idea of, I think I'm finding that out through continuous sobriety or coming up to almost 2 years, which is pretty
awesome,
remarkable. Yeah. I'm sort of waving my hands in the air to listeners. But so sure, I'm not 20 years, but for me, that gear changing already, for me, there's almost like a fear. You know, I've recoiled so much from it, but it's still so recent, and so I can have perfect photographic like flashbacks of many, many moments and things, and especially in the last couple of months or last year, when I was, you know, really. My shovel and I was digging and I was digging and I was like, and I, here I am thinking, yeah, I've got this, you know, I'm quite a smart person, kind of all these things. But I couldn't work that out at all. So, yeah. Hey, should we play another track, do you think? And then we can come back. What have we got lined up here?
It's Come On, Eileen, I think. That was your pick,
that's
Morgan.
The one, yeah.
Yep.
This brings back memories.
We'll be right back.
Listeners. Hey Morgan, like since you know, you're talking before about like the sort of gifts of recovery and your work and your family and your sobriety, and do you want to tell us a bit about your family? Because you always speak really highly of your family, eh?
Yeah. Well, I've got two families really. I've got the family I was born into. I've got five siblings, three sisters and two brothers, and we're all estranged. Mum and dad are both passed on. They're gone. And the last time I saw my family was when we buried our mum in 2017. And the time that we got together again as a family was when we buried our dad, buried my father in 1995. Those are the only two times we've ever been together as a family. Mm-hmm. So my family today is my partner, my partner's family, and my three grandsons. I've got three grandsons. And, I just revolve everything around my family. And, you know, like today, like I knocked off early today, went home to have a shower and stuff like that. And Yvonne's, just as I'm pulling up, she's away to get the boys from school. And so that happens every day in our house. Because mum and dad work, they come around in the morning for breakfast, get dropped off at our house for breakfast. Yvonne takes them to school, or I'll take them to school. And then... So that's been going on since the day they were born. Oh my God, I just can't describe the love that I have for those boys and their mum and dad, you know. And look, I'll tell you, like it might seem like nothing special, but I love watching their mum and dad parent them as well. And, you know, there was this one time where my oldest the middle grandson, he's nine now, but this would have been when he was about six or seven, and his older cousin, who lives in Christchurch, he's got a bike round home, but he'd outgrown it, and the middle grandson had outgrown his, so it was time to put him on the bigger grandson's bike to see... You know, because the parents didn't want to spend lots and lots of money on a brand new bike for him. And so they're standing outside our gate, and he's on the bike, and he just has to step up a little bit, and it's bigger than what he's used to. And so he starts crying. My middle grandson, he's very emotional, really, really cries at the drop of a hat. And he's soft, he's just beautiful. And anyway, he says to his dad, "Dad, can I ask you a question? And Dad goes, yes, son. What do you want to know? And he goes, why are you making me ride this bike when I don't want to? And Dad goes, because this is going to be your new bike, mate. We're not spending lots and lots of money on a brand new bike for you, and we just want to see if you can ride it. So we just go to the corner and come back. All right, so, okay, Dad. So Dad pushed him off, and he rode down to the corner and he came back. By the time he got back, he was smiling, grinning from ear to ear. And that was his bike from that moment on, right? I watched that whole scene of him saying to his dad, can I ask you a question, Dad? And Dad going, yeah, of course you can. Why are you blah, blah, blah? And Dad saying, because, and explaining to him. And I just thought that was just gorgeous. That was beautiful, you know.
So cool. It's really cool. I love hearing you talk about your family.
Oh, it was amazing. It was just amazing, mate. You know, it was just like Dad being a dad to his son. And the relationship he's got with his boys and their mum is, he comes to pick them up. He gets them, comes around home. And anyway, he comes around home after work to pick them up. And the younger one, Awa, his name is Awa. The older one's Nohia. And Awa jumps on his knee and he's just sitting there just telling his dad about his day. And his dad, he's a funny bugger. He's cheeky as well. He starts blowing into Awa's face while Awa's talking to him, blowing, and like constantly just blowing. And Awa just goes, you want me to keep talking, mate? You know what I mean? They've got a relationship like it's just like, they're just like mates, you know. Their father and son with both of them, but they're just so close. And those boys have a relationship with their father that is just beautiful. And
now their grandfather as well.
Yeah.
And that's what you're present, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're integrated.
Yeah.
You're one of, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they need you.
Yeah.
You need them. It's,
yeah.
It's,
yeah.
It sounds pretty special.
That is. It is.
Kind of gifts of recovery, eh?
Yeah. And then you got mum and Nana. They're just, you know, they're all part of the package. We got a pretty good thing going, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
And that's that type of, what do you think, Mike, in terms of, we sort of started on family relationships at the beginning and, for me, it's been really good with my elder sisters in terms of the last couple of years. And one of them in London, you know, didn't really have an understanding or had even an idea that I was in trouble or, you know, really struggling with that. And she was recently out in New Zealand and that was really cool to sort of work that through. And because, you know, when you just text or on the phone every now and then, they don't understand sometimes your fault life.
What's going
they just
on?
Think, yeah. Oh, Sue's extreme, you know, she's always doing things, she's, you know, doing so much. And yet, you know, inside there was quite a different life going on, you know.
Well, we've been quite good at masking and active drinking and stuff, eh? To the wider public at times until it all turns to, you know, we can be good at masking it so people aren't aware. Your family, especially people you don't see regularly, can be unaware of your struggles, eh?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I can relate to that. Like I've found, yeah, my relationship with my parents and like they're getting older and stuff. You know, they're both in their mid to late 70s. And I'm just really glad that you see me sober and clean, you know, which is cool. And I, you know, I don't really think I deserve it. I don't feel like I deserve it, but they're like really proud of my recovery and stuff. I kind of feel like I don't deserve pride and stuff, but it's really lovely. And I've got it's really nice to see them. They were in town a few weeks ago and my dad even commented on, you know, how good I seemed. And cause usually, you know, in my active drinking days, most of our hanging outs would end in some kind of a, you know, argument or something. But yeah, it's cool. And same with my brother. He was in town a couple of weeks ago and went out for lunch with him. But that's definitely something I've, gained in my recovery, in my short period of recovery.
Good on you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So gifts of recovery.
Nice. Hey, well, that should be our show for tonight. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, cool.
And Morgan, you've been excellent.
Yeah, you guys have been awesome too.
Yeah, just sort of it's really important to hear the length and breadth, if you like, of your life and what it's taken you to and to come into recovery and to just really be so invested in that. And it's, for me, it's, in meetings with you or when I'm getting to know you now, it's just, it's very special. And it's something I do think about many times during the week. It's not just in the meeting. I think about, you know, people often, and that gives me a lot of laughter as well. You know, we have a lot of good times as well.
It's cool. It's been really cool for me because I'm sort of still going through legal stuff from, you know, stemming from my, you know, my addictive behaviours and things. So it's just really cool seeing, you know, a role model, somebody who's been there and then actually made something really cool and positive of their life. And that sort of gives, you know, I think that's where you really find hope and stuff in the rooms, which is cool. So thanks for that.
No, thank you guys. Thank you guys. I'm inspired by you guys. this is like you're carrying the message and you're doing service and you're seeking your own recoveries, like just from doing this, you know. I wasn't doing that when I first came along. So, yeah.
But as you said, you know, life or death.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
And I have to say, and sometimes I share it, sometimes I keep it to myself, but I was definitely sliding very quickly to that, the big D.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mike, would you like to wrap up the show, please?
Do you want me to close it out?
Yeah, let's do that. Awesome.
Yep, so shall I just sort of close us off with these acknowledgements and then kick in a song to kind of close
that'd
it
be
out?
Wonderful,
okay,
yeah.
Cool. So Alcoholics Anonymous is based on a 12-step program. For those that aren't sure what that means, the 12 steps outline a path to spiritual progress through a series of actions designed to draw out what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous refers to as a psychic change, a complete mental, emotional and spiritual shift in perception. We believe the 12 steps can be a critical element of a long-term recovery program. So thank you for spending the evening with us, reminding our listeners that if you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to stop, that's ours. That's where we can help. Here are two ways to contact Alcoholics Anonymous. You can call us on 0800 AA Works. That's 0800 229 6757, or you can go to our New Zealand website, aa.org.nz. And I'm going to close it out tonight with a song by Big Thief, who sort of one of my favourite contemporary artists. The songwriter Adrienne Linker is herself in recovery. And this is a really cool song because, for all intents and purposes, you can kind of read it as a breakup sort of, you know, toxic relationship song, because it's called Paul. But Paul is actually personified, it's sort of alcohol personified. So it's talking about sort of breaking up with Paul, but that's sort of breaking up with alcohol. But I thought that's it's a beautiful song and quite a cool way to finish.
Take care, everyone. Until next time, Matewa.
Matewa.
Yay. Oh, last time I saw Paul, I was horrible and almost let him in. But I stopped and caught the wall, and my mouth got dry, so all I did was take him for a spin. Yeah, we hopped inside my car, and I drove in circles round. Paul. I know you said that you'd take me any way I came or went, but I'll push you from my...
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.